As this nation heads into the heavy eating season, NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg is back from a country where it was once impossible to get a bad meal. Then things went downhill. Now, says Susan, great French food is coming back.
Americans who were lucky enough to go to France decades ago never forgot their first encounter with great French cooking. For Michael Steinberger, it was some peas he ate in the Loire Valley in 1980.
Now you think, you're 13-year-old American kid, what the hell do you know from peas? But that was the thing. The peas were so absolutely delicious. I never tasted anything this good.
Some 30 years later, in a book called Au Revoir to All That, Food, Wine, and the End of France, Steinberger says those pea epiphanies are long past for various reasons.
France is now McDonald's second most profitable market in the world.
And McDonald's is the largest private sector employer in the country. A McDo's, as they call it, will open in the food court of the Louvre. Sacre bleu! What happened? Well, working families have less time for home cooking. Young people aren't raised on great food. French wine, cheese, and bread makers have had all kinds of problems. Plus, running a restaurant is hard work in France. High taxes, loads of bureaucracy, stifling rules.
You've seen a lot of young chefs, very talented ones, leave to open restaurants in New York and London because it was a heck of a lot easier to open a business in these cities and to run one and to turn a profit.
Ça va? Bon, très bien. Ce soir, complet, ça...
But there is a mini revolution underway, a rethinking and reviving of classic French cooking. The heck with the demanding Michelin rating system that awards coveted and stress-producing stars to formal, fortune-charging temples of food. The new way, Michael Steinberger says, is called bistronomy.
Bistronomy is this idea that's taken root here in Paris of young, very talented chefs who have decided, you know what, we don't want anything to do with this Michelin system. We don't care about winning 3 stars. We don't want to have these luxury palaces where you've got 5 or 6 people in penguin suits hovering over you. We don't want to do that, and the clientele doesn't want it anymore. What they want is good food at a price they can afford.
Their guru is a cheerful, scratchy-voiced dynamo named Christian Constant. 59 now, Constant began apprenticing in kitchens when he was 14. For 8 years, he was chef at the Crillon, one of Paris's top hotels. He walked away from a pretty certain 3rd star there and opened a small place near the Eiffel Tower. Leave the Crillon? Constant's Scottish wife, Catherine, tells why.
He had the impression that he was falling asleep in the kitchen, that he was getting a bit stagnating.
So he left and encouraged a generation of marvelous young chefs who'd apprenticed with him over the years to do the same. Now Christian Constant has 4 small and lively restaurants all on the same Paris street. One serves mostly fish, another casseroles. The French president ate there. A 3rd is a corner cafe, and the 4th is an upscale bistro. On a recent Saturday night, Parisians began arriving at 7, for them a decidedly unchic hour, to get tables and terrific food at reasonable prices.
On est à l'aise, on travaille pas avec la peur.
Now we have this restaurant where everybody enjoys working, and we love the relationship that we have with the clients now. It's much more relaxed, but still professional.
I'm eating a scallop, and then qu'est-ce que c'est? Du beurre?
Ouais, c'est du beurre, du jus d'orange.
Constant's kitchens are tiny and jammed with soups and stocks and sous chefs. It's like a rugby team, he says. Playing alone, you're nothing. But together, it's really back to bon appetit. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News, with recent memories of scallops and butter and oranges and peas and endives.
Alas, there are no nibbles, but you can get a list of restaurants, some pictures, menus at NPR.org. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Now let's turn our attention to a place that is as far away from Capitol Hill as we can imagine, Astronomers say they have detected the most distant object anyone has ever seen in the universe. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
One nice thing about the universe is it still holds some surprises. Neil Tanvir from the University of Leicester in England was lucky enough to find one.
The thing that we've discovered is called a gamma ray burst. It's a kind of exploding star, which these things are brighter than anything else we know of in the universe. So in principle, you can see them very far away, but they're incredibly rare.
But two teams of astronomers were lying in wait. They used a NASA satellite called SWIFT to find bursts of gamma rays, then scrambled to figure out where they came from. This burst, on April 23rd, turns out to have come from so far away and so far back in time, the universe was a mere 600 million years old when the star exploded, according to the report in Nature. The light from that explosion took 13 billion years to reach Earth.
It's absolutely thrilling, spine-tingling moment, actually, but in a sense, it was also a big relief.
Astronomers using the SWIFT satellite had designed their entire observing strategy to find very young and faraway objects, so not finding the most distant object in the universe would actually have been a disappointment. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And you can see what an ancient explosion looks like at our website, npr.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Matthew Ho is a man who has seen the U.S. conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan up close. Now he's become the first U.S. official to publicly resign in protest over the war in Afghanistan. Ho began his public service in the Marine Corps. Then as a civilian Defense Department employee, he led reconstruction efforts in Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit. Later, as a captain in the Marines, he fought in Iraq's Anbar province, where he was cited for uncommon bravery. And after his stints in Iraq, Ho signed on as a Foreign Service officer in Afghanistan, working on development efforts in Zabul province, a hotbed of the Taliban. Last month, Ho resigned, saying in his resignation letter that he had lost understanding of and confidence in the strategic purpose of the United States' presence in Afghanistan. And Matthew Ho joins us to explain that decision. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Melissa.
In your resignation letter to the State Department, you said, "My resignation is based not upon how we are pursuing this war, but why and to what end." Can you explain what you meant by that?
I'm not so much concerned about the how of the war. I'm not so much concerned about debating General McChrystal's views or any of the views of the folks here in D.C., that think tank crowd. I'm more concerned about why we're in Afghanistan. Why are we losing soldiers and Marines in combat to people who are fighting us, really only because we're occupying them? Why are we supporting an Afghan government who, if we are successful in stabilizing it, that stabilization won't defeat al-Qaeda? And if Pakistan is a priority because of its nuclear weapons, then why do we have 60,000 troops in Afghanistan, and why are we not fully supporting Pakistan? And so those are the issues that I really feel need to be addressed, and I really hope the American people understand what we're doing there. To me, it does not make any sense in terms of the losses of our soldiers do not merit anything that comes in line with our strategic interests or values.
This is quite a lengthy and at times emotional resignation letter that you sent to the State Department. One point you make is that we have understood the true nature of the Afghan insurgency. You use the word valleyism. Why don't you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. I think everyone is familiar with the term nationalism. We have seen that throughout our history in terms of from our own revolution, where we fought out of nationalist concerns to, you know, most recently the Vietnam War, where I believe we mistook what was Vietnamese nationalism for some type of communist threat. In Afghanistan, everything's much more localized. Allegiance is really to your family and then to your village and or your valley, and that's what they fight for. There has not been a traditional central government there, and I don't believe the central government is wanted. And actually, I believe they fight the central government just as much as they fight foreign occupiers.
Can you compare what you saw in your time in Afghanistan? You were there for about 5 months, with what you saw in Iraq. You were there at the height of the Sunni insurgency. Why have you concluded the war in Afghanistan is fundamentally unwinnable?
Yeah, I don't want to go down a path about talking about whether or not it's winnable or not. I prefer to keep talking about, is it worth winning? Is it worth losing more lives? Is it worth spending billions of dollars that, frankly, this country does not have? I don't feel it's unwinnable. I just don't feel it's not worth winning. No one has been able to answer to me, why are we there? And that's what I'm looking for.
You were in Afghanistan for about 5 months. That's not a huge amount of time. Do you really think it's enough time on the ground to fully understand the situation in all parts of the country?
Yes, I do, because I was fortunate to have served time in two different parts of the country. I served time in the east, where our forces are heavily engaged in Kunar and Nuristan provinces, as well as time in the south, where our forces are also heavily engaged. I had done quite a bit of studying. I have many friends and colleagues who had served in Afghanistan prior to me going there. And then most importantly, the position I had as a political advisor, my job was to work with local Afghans on a daily basis. And I did, and I was able to get out. I was able to meet with local Afghans throughout the east and the south of the country. And they're the ones who really codified my thoughts on this. And you realize that what they want is to be left alone.
The question then would be, if they are left alone, as you say, if the Taliban were to take over in Afghanistan again, would Al-Qaeda regroup there? I know you have said that you don't think they would. Secretary of State Clinton disagrees entirely. She has said, if the Taliban take over Afghanistan, I can't tell you how fast Al-Qaeda would be back in Afghanistan. Is she wrong?
I don't believe that's correct. I believe that after 2001, we disrupted Al-Qaeda and chased Al-Qaeda and Taliban out of Afghanistan, that Al-Qaeda evolved. And Al-Qaeda became basically an ideological cloud that exists on the internet. I don't believe Al-Qaeda will ever again tie itself to a geographical or political boundary. I believe they have evolved and that they get recruits worldwide. They're not looking for a safe haven in Afghanistan. They don't need that. They've already got safe havens in half a dozen other countries, Somalia, Sudan, Yemen. And more to the point, if you look at the successful attacks Al-Qaeda has had, including 9/11, the vast majority of those attackers are not from the Pashto belt of Afghanistan or Pakistan. Many of them are Western European or from the Gulf. And so much of that training and planning for those attacks, whether it was 9/11, Madrid, London, took place in Western Europe or you know, hey, I mean, as everyone knows, the 9/11 attacks, a lot of that training happened here in the U.S.
You're talking about the flight schools.
Correct. So I think what we're doing is we have an approach where we haven't evolved ourselves. We're still set up to do our foreign policy and our defense operations like we were in 1991, and we need to change. Al-Qaeda changed. They evolved. They got smart about how they were going to do their operations. We need to do the same. And more to the point, say we do continue to occupy Afghanistan. And say, hey, we even go farther. Say we occupy Pakistan. Occupation only reinforces the message of Al-Qaeda. Occupation only causes people to want to fight the West and to join their ranks.
And your message is, it is not just now that you feel this is the case. You feel this has always been the case in Afghanistan.
That's correct. Of course, we had to go in there in 2001. We had to drive the Taliban from power. We had to do our best to destroy Al-Qaeda. But that was 8 years ago, and things have changed. And we have just basically, because we have been unthinking in our approach, I think, because we've been unflexible in our approach, we just continue to march down this path where now we have 60,000 troops and we're looking to bolster it to 80 or 100,000. And we just keep going into more valleys and finding more enemies because we're going into their valleys. But yes, I do believe that we're now in a position where we have to really fundamentally change our approach to fighting Al-Qaeda.
Matthew Ho, you end your resignation with this thought. Families must be reassured their dead have sacrificed for a purpose worthy of futures lost, love vanished, and promised dreams unkept. I have lost confidence. Such assurances can any more be made. What message do you think that sends to families of the more than 800 troops who've already died in Afghanistan? Was it a lost cause? Were those deaths, do you think, in vain?
This is that's a very difficult question, and it's a very emotional question. I just had a friend this week pass away in Afghanistan. It's very hard to say that. It was very difficult for me to write that, but I don't believe we should continue losing and sacrificing our young men and women for goals that meet no strategic purpose to the United States. And the idea that we should continue fighting there just because we have been fighting there for the last 8 years, I think is completely irrational.
Matthew Ho, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you, Melissa.
Matthew Ho resigned his post with the State Department in Afghanistan last month. You can read his resignation letter at our website, npr.org. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block in California.
And I'm Robert Siegel in Washington. On this date, 40 years ago, something called the ARPANET came into existence. And since then, communication hasn't been the same. NPR's Guy Raz, host of the weekend edition of this program, talked with some of the people behind its creation.
Charlie Klein's lonely moment in history unfolded inside a large, empty computer lab at UCLA at 10:30 at night on October 29th, 1969.
And I was 21 and a programmer who liked to program all hours of the day and night.
Nights spent with the SDS Sigma 7. It was a computer about the size of a one-bedroom apartment. And that one night, October 29th, Charlie Klein sent an electronic message from the Sigma 7 to another computer at the Stanford Research Institute in Menlo Park, California. And that transmission would literally transform the way we communicate today. But to tell the story of how it happened, we have to start with the context in which it happened. A communication revolution was happening, except that it was happening over the telephone.
This is the automatic dialer. Just listen for dial tone, insert a number card, and press the start bar. The Bell System automatic dialer dials for you more quickly and easily than you can do it yourself.
Telephones were for communicating, and computers were built to process information, to do things like payroll and crunch numbers. You're hearing the IBM 1401. It was a computer system about the size of a two-car garage. On a recent afternoon at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California, a few old-timers got it up and running to demonstrate what it could do. And what it could do was process about as much information as your cell phone, your old ratty cell phone from the 1980s. In fact, if you took all the computers in the museum's main exhibit hall, and we're talking about a space the size of 4 football fields.
It's fair to say that your BlackBerry has more computing power than all of the computers in this room combined.
That's Bill DeVall. He was at the Stanford Research Institute on the receiving end of Charlie Klein's message the night of October 29th, 1969. Now, nearly 4 years before Bill and Charlie did the Internet equivalent of the moon landing, a man named Bob Taylor was sitting in his office at the Pentagon, where he worked for the department's Advanced Research Projects Agency, or ARPA, and he was frustrated. Taylor had 3 computer terminals in his office, and each one connected to a different computer in a different part of the country.
To get in touch with someone in Santa Monica through the computer, I would sit in front of one terminal, but to do the same thing with someone in Massachusetts, I would have to get up and move over to another terminal. And you don't have to look at this very long to realize this is silly. It's stupid. So I decided, okay, I want to build a network that connects all of these.
And so Taylor started to collect really smart people, people who could build that network, people like Bill DeVall at SRI in Menlo Park, Professor Len Kleinrock at UCLA, and the young Charlie Klein. Taylor also sent word to the biggest technology companies that they could bid on a contract to help build that network. Charlie Klein remembers what happened next.
IBM refused to bid, as did AT&T. They both said, can't be done, it's useless. They saw the future of computing as bigger and bigger mainframes.
So a smaller company, Bolt, Beranek, and Newman, got the contract, and it built a device called the IMP, the Interface Message Processor. It was as big as 2 full-size gym lockers. Charlie Klein explains how it worked.
So I would type a character, would go into my computer, my software would take it, wrap around it all the necessary software to send it to the IMP. The IMP would take it and say, oh, this is supposed to go up to SRI.
Think about it like your home internet router, only 100 times bigger. Anyway, it took about a year for BB&N to build several of these IMPs and then get them into place at different locations in the country, including at UCLA and SRI.
At some point, we were ready to test it. It wasn't like we had planned, you know, on October 29th. You know, we got to a point where I'm ready to test, or you're ready to test, and we decided to do that.
And so late on the 29th of October, 1969, Charlie Klein, sitting at the UCLA computer lab, placed a phone call to Bill Duvall at Stanford.
We didn't walk into a darkened room, turn on the lights, flip a switch, and have it work. This was something that we tried, some number of times. We were hooked up with a telephone headset, and we were talking to each other.
Charlie Klein started to type the historic message, an online communication roughly equivalent to what the Neanderthal is to the modern man. This is how Len Kleinrock, the man who headed UCLA's computer lab, recalls the event.
We should have prepared a wonderful message. Certainly Samuel Morse did when he prepared What Hath God Wrought, a beautiful biblical quotation. Or Alexander Graham Bell, Come Here, Watson, I Need You. Armstrong, Up on the Moon, A Giant Leap for Mankind. These guys were smart. They understood public relations. They had quotes ready for history, and we still remember those quotes. All we wanted to do on October 29th was to send a simple login capability from UCLA to SRI. We just wanted to log into the SRI machine from UCLA.
And so the first computer network communication was, well, it was supposed to be the word login, L-O-G-I-N.
So the first thing I typed was an L.
Over the phone, Bill Duvall told Charlie Klein, I got the L.
I typed an O and he got the O.
And then Klein typed the G.
And he had a bug and it crashed.
It crashed.
And that was it. The first ever computer network communication was L-O. The ARPANET was born. About an hour later, at 10:30, they got it to work. They successfully transmitted the word L-O-G-I-N. Charlie Klein scribbled some notes into a logbook and went home to bed. Bill Duvall also called it a night. On the way home, he stopped for a quick burger and a beer. Was that how you celebrated, I asked? No, he said. I was hungry.
That's our colleague Guy Raz, who hosts this program on the weekend. That's when you can hear more stories in our series, The Net at 40.
And we're about to celebrate an anniversary that may not exist. That's because reasonable people disagree about what exactly marks the beginning of the Internet. We do know that 40 years ago today, two guys here in California sent a five-letter message over a primitive computer network. Some people say that was the Internet's Big Bang. And NPR's All Things Considered, we'll have a story about that tonight. For now, we wanted to consider what has flowed from that very first message.
You on YouTube?
No, Hulu. You?
iTunes. But I lost the USB for my MP3.
It's MIA.
Yeah. So is my GPS.
Ugh, I'm gonna lose it.
What?
This PDF won't show up on the LCD.
Call the ISP.
Or I could send them an SMS.
Maybe it's a cookie thing.
Yeah, I could look it up on the cookie wiki.
So you're on Google now?
No, Bing. You're such a Yahoo.
Yoo-hoo! I just got poked on Facebook.
Who from?
My mom. She wants to know if she can use PayPal on Netflix.
Hey, did she ever sell her iMac on eBay?
No, but she did get Wi-Fi for the Xbox.
Wait a minute. Can we have a real conversation?
Sure, I guess.
But can we have it in Second Life?
And that was a special presentation by Click and Drag, the Morning Edition players. This evening, All Things Considered launches a series looking back at 40 years of the Internet.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel in Washington.
I'm Melissa Block at NPR West in California. And Robert, I'm going to list some movie titles. These are movies that I bet you've seen.
Okay.
No Country for Old Men.
Saw it.
Okay. A Beautiful Mind, about the schizophrenic math genius.
Saw that one. The book was better.
Yeah. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? Fargo, both directed by the Coen brothers.
Saw them both.
Shawshank Redemption, remember the prison movie with Tim Robbins?
Absolutely.
You've seen all these movies.
Yeah. Many times, yes.
One thing connecting all of these movies, Robert, dozens more movies too, they were all shot by one cinematographer named Roger Deakins. He's been nominated for 8 Oscars now. Roger Deakins lives in Santa Monica, and the other day I met him at his house. It's a beautiful arts and crafts style house that he helped design, and I went there, of course, to talk about movie making. But first, we looked at some black and white still pictures that he has framed on the wall. They're pictures he's taken, many of them on the English coast, where he's from, in Devon. There's an old couple licking ice cream cones, a happy dog in mid-jump on the beach.
I love light because it changes every second. And, I spent most of my childhood in boats and fishing and stuff from dawn to dusk and skipping school and just going fishing. And that's all about the light and the weather, you know, so I'm sure that did have an influence.
And as the California light dissolved into a sunset, we sat down to watch an intricate, intense scene from No Country for Old Men, another one of the Coen brothers' movies. It's the middle of the night, a motel with crime scene tape stretched outside room 114. Cut to an inside shot. The psychopath, played by Javier Bardem, is gripping a gun, a sliver of his face barely illuminated by a dim crescent of light. Then, cut back outside, the sheriff, played by Tommy Lee Jones, walks up cautiously. His shadow looms on the door.
To me, this is one of the most successful scenes, and it was just something there. I think that's fabulous, the close-up of the hole where the lock was. He gets his gun out. And then he pushes the door open and he stands there in this backlit shot with the headlight you can see of the car. And then you reverse and he pans the room and we cheated it so it's though both the headlights hit his silhouette and you've got this really fractured, odd image. And
his shadow on the wall.
And that was just something that we came up with at the time and thought, well, we got to use that. You know, I love light. When you see something like that, you go, whoa. You get a kind of high, really, I suppose. That makes sense. It's the little things in my life, you see.
When you're before you start filming and you're working with the directors, thinking it through ahead of time, walk us through how that works. What are you doing? How much are you laying out?
Well, you know, it's what's really interesting and stimulating about my job is that every experience with a director is different. So working with Joel and Ethan, things there's a long prep time.
The Coen brothers.
Yeah, the Coen brothers, yeah. Basically, the whole film is storyboarded. I mean, drawings are done of the way they want the images to cut together and the feeling of the movie all the way through. And, you know, the antithesis of that was when the first film I did with Sam Mendes was Jarhead, about the Iraqi war. Basically, he said, I want this to be really spontaneous. I want to shoot it handheld, and I want just to be able to shoot rehearsals. And sometimes we would go in and shoot even before the action was staged with the actors, you know. And then together we would work with the actors and develop the scene so it in an organic way with the camera.
If you're working, say, with the Coen brothers and everything is very carefully, meticulously laid out ahead of time, where does serendipity fit in there?
Well, Conrad Hall was a great, I mean, the greatest cinematographer, probably. He always called it the happy accident that always happens on a set, that sometimes you'll see something will happen and you realise you can do something visually, either with lighting or with the way you move the camera, that you couldn't have done on the page, in the script, in the words, you know, and that happens a lot. I mean, it's usually we might do a scene in one shot instead of covering it in five, you know. Most people think, well, if you storyboard it, it's just a mechanical way of filmmaking. But I don't see it as that. Not with them, anyway. I'm sure with some people that it is, and especially, you know, mostly storyboards are done for big special effects films where, you know, it's really important to have the special effects all worked out so everybody knows what little element of the shot they have to do. And there's probably not so much freedom that way. Of course, now there's more freedom because with digital technology, actually, that's changing as well, you know.
You can fix things, you mean reinvent things?
Fix things in post. It's one of the worst expressions to come into the industry. But on the other hand, again, take a film like Jarhead, which we shot it all handheld in the desert, but in the background there's mountains, and Sam didn't want anything, no mountains. He wanted this flat, kind of surreal landscape, emptiness, horizon going into nothing. So all the mountains were taken out digitally afterwards. But if it's used correctly, it's a fantastic technique. But
well, that's the danger, I suppose. I mean, this fix it in post, I can tell by the way you say it.
Right.
You hate it. It's anathema to you, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Why? Because Explain why.
Well, you can be on the set and suddenly it's used too freely and there's certain things you can't fix in post. There's certain things that would no longer look organic if you did it in post, really. You know, it's one thing removing a mountain in the background of a shot. It's another thing adding 15,000 people and, you know, changing somebody's face. And, you know, that kind of manipulation, I think, gives itself away eventually.
When you watch a movie? Can you pick it out?
Mostly, yes. But then it's interesting because sometimes, you know, on the film Oh Brother, We're Art Thou, again with the Coen brothers, there's a scene where they hit this cow, right? and they run over this cow. And we had the Society of Protection for Animals, right, ring us up and said, you killed a cow. And they had to go down to the effects house, and the effects guys had to go show them through the stages of how they'd animated this cow to look like it had been run over by a car.
So no car was, no cow was hurt in the making of this movie.
Well, they said that at the end, I think, didn't they? No cow was hurt in the making of this movie. So sometimes it, you know, for most people, me, I look at it, if I really studied it, I thought, well, I'd see an edge there. The shadow's not quite the same on the cow as it is to the tree over there or whatever. You know, it doesn't seem in quite the same space. But, you know, often you really have to look at it hard.
But other times you can really, if you're watching somebody else's movie, if it looks phony, if it looks manipulated, you might be able to tell.
Yes. And then that's, I think that's what I mean. That's when you lose an audience. And I, you know, I mean, that's the whole discussion about camera style and lighting and how much that the imagery and the photography and the effects really are there to serve a story. There's nothing worse than an ostentatious shot in my head or some lighting that draws attention to itself. And you might go, oh, wow, that's spectacular. Or that's a spectacular shot, you know, big crane move or something. But it's not necessarily right for the film because you jump out, you think about the surface, and you don't stay in there with the characters and the story.
Well, Roger Deakins, thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you. My pleasure. It's great.
Cinematographer Roger Deakins, his most recent movie with the Coen brothers is A Serious Man. You can watch and listen as Deakins narrates how he shot a scene from The Shawshank Redemption at npr.org.